Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to sift through the complex stuff and pull out the essentials, the things you really need to know. Today, we're tackling a real firebrand, Gustave Courbet.
Courbet, yeah, 1819 to 1877. Not just an artist, but really the founder of French realism. Fiercely independent, maybe a bit arrogant, you could say, but absolutely central. He basically built his career by, well, breaking all the rules.
And you really can't get that defiance without understanding the world he was in, 19th century France. I mean, it was just constantly churning, politically speaking.
It's absolutely. It was incredibly unstable. His life covers this dizzying period. You know, you've got the fallout from the revolution, Napoleon I, the Bourbons coming back, the 1848 revolution, then Napoleon III, the Commune, the Third Republic. It's a whirlwind.
Wow, that's quite the list. So all that upheaval, it wasn't just background noise for him. It kind of fueled his rebellion.
It definitely did. It meant that everything felt charged. What an artist chose to paint, who they painted, that was a political statement, whether they intended it or not.
Yeah.
And Courbet's whole thing, painting only what he could physically see, that wasn't just about style. It was, well, deeply political.
Right. So our mission today, then, is to explore how that focus on raw, unvarnished truth, it didn't just, you know, put ordinary life on the map artistically. It fundamentally shook the establishment and really paved the way for modern art. Okay, let's dive in. So, Courbet the man, where did he come from? Not Paris originally, right?
No. He was from Ornolmes, near the Swiss border. Came from a pretty well-off farming family, actually. And he seems to have carried that sort of earthy confidence with him. Sources mention his boisterous confidence and physical vigor. He wasn't some delicate city type.
That background feels important. His subjects often weren't Parisian elites. They were people he knew, right? His family, neighbors.
Exactly. The landscapes around Ornolmes, his sisters, local folks. He brought this sort of unprettified humanity to these huge canvases.
But when he did get to Paris around 21, he famously skipped the official art school, the École des Beaux-Arts. Just wasn't interested in their strict classical training.
Not at all. He basically made up his own education. Spent ages in the Louvre, just copying the old masters he admired. People like Caravaggio with that dramatic light and Rubens with all that energy.
Okay, so he's looking at how they painted saints and myths. That powerful light and shadow, the chiaroscuro. But he's thinking about using it differently.
Precisely. He learned their techniques, that drama, but wanted to apply it to the weight of everyday truth. So you take that grand style, but you point it at a farmer or some rocks, not a god or a king. That gave his subjects a kind of dignity they hadn't really had before in art.
And you see that confidence, maybe that intensity really early on, like in The Desperate Man, that self-portrait from the 1840s.
Oh, yeah. That wild look tearing at his hair.
Yeah.
It's got both swagger and this raw vulnerability. You know, he's already confronting the viewer, even then.
That confrontational style seemed to spill over into his life, too. He never married, did he? Famously, he said something quite dramatic about it.
He did. Told his family he was as inclined to get married as I am to hang myself. Pretty clear. Art came first, always.
Although he did have a relationship, a long one, with his model Virginie Binet, and they had a son.
Yes, for about 10 years, they had a son, Désiré Alfred Émile. But then around 1851, the sources just say they vanished from his life, quite abruptly.
Seems he was, as they say, a restless bohemian. Really put his art above everything.
Absolutely. And that single-minded focus, that defiance, that's what leads him into his most revolutionary period.
Right. This is where things really heat up. Courbet's big idea, the really radical part, was saying that ordinary life, you know, messy, unglamorous life, deserved the same treatment as big historical events or myths. Same huge canvases, same serious attention.
He puts that right out there with After Dinner at Ornans in 1848-49. The subject matter is almost mundane. His dad, some friends, just relaxing after dinner, unidealized. But the size of it, it's huge, nearly 2 meters by 2.5 meters.
Taking this quiet everyday scene and blowing it up to history painting scale must have ruffled some feathers.
Oh, it did. Conservative critics thought it was coarse, you know, ugly. But others, like the writer Sean Fleury, hailed it as revolutionary truth painting.
And getting that painting into the Salon of 1849 was a big win, strategically too, wasn't it?
Massive. It won a gold medal. And crucially, that medal meant he no longer had to submit his work to the Salon jury for approval. He was free. That cemented his controversial independence.
And he didn't waste time using that freedom. He quickly followed up with the Stonebreakers in 1849. Pure social realism.
Yeah, depicting the sheer grind of manual labor. Two peasants, one young, one old, just breaking rocks by the road. It's about the brutal and monotonous nature of their work.
And the detail about their faces. he deliberately didn't show them clearly, right?
Exactly. That's key.
Yeah.
By hiding their faces, they stop being just those two specific guys and become symbols. Symbols of the oppressed working poor everywhere. It makes the painting universal. Such a tragedy that work was destroyed during World War II.
A huge loss. But the painting that caused the biggest uproar was probably A Burial at Ornans, finished in 1850. This thing is, well, it's enormous. 6 meters long.
We need to pause on this one.
Yeah.
Imagine seeing this giant canvas. And it's not depicting the burial of Christ or some famous battle, but the funeral of an ordinary guy, probably his great uncle back in his hometown, with all the local townspeople just standing there.
That scale was the scandal, wasn't it? Giving a common man's funeral the same epic treatment usually reserved for royalty or religious figures.
Absolutely. It was seen as an affront. Why waste that kind of canvas on peasants? One critic famously sneered he'd painted peasants in Sunday best. But for Courbet, it was a deliberate democratic statement. These ordinary people, their lives, their deaths, deserve that grandeur.
So by the mid-1850s, he wasn't just pushing boundaries, he was actively breaking away from the system.
Completely. The big break comes in 1855. The Exposition Universelle, basically the World's Fair in Paris, their jury rejects his huge, ambitious painting, The Painter's Studio.
And Courbet's reaction, he doesn't just complain.
No way. He funds his own exhibition. Builds a temporary building right across the street from the official expo and calls it the Pavillon du Réalisme, the Pavilion of Realism.
That's incredibly bold. Is that the first time an artist did something like that?
It's certainly one of the most famous early examples, a real pioneering move for independent exhibitions. It basically showed other artists, like the later Impressionists, that you could go outside the official system.
Okay, but was it just pure artistic principle or was there a big ego involved there too? I mean, couldn't handle the rejection.
Oh, probably a bit of both. That's Courbet. His ego was enormous, but he weaponized it, used it to push his art forward. And the Painter's Studio itself, I mean, the subtitle says it all. A real allegory summing up 7 years of my artistic and moral life. It's him, the artist, literally at the center of his world.
Right. You see him there painting a landscape. And he's got figures around him. On one side, his supporters.
Yep. On the right, you've got his allies. Baudelaire the poet, Proudhon the philosopher, his patron Bruyas, people who represented modern thought.
And the other side, that's more mysterious.
It is. It's a mix of figures representing ordinary life, but also society's problems, the wretched and powerful. There's a poacher who supposedly looks like Napoleon III, a priest, a merchant, an impoverished woman. It's society in all its complexity.
It's his whole worldview on one canvas, and it connects back to that famous quote of his.
I cannot paint an angel because I have never seen one. That's the core of it. No fantasy, no myths, just what you can observe, what's real.
That self-reliance, that I am the master here attitude, it even shows up in how he painted his patrons, doesn't it? Like in the meeting.
Bonjour, Monsieur Courbet, yeah, from 1854, commissioned by Alfred Bruyas, his wealthy patron.
But the painting makes Courbet look like the important one. He's standing tall, looking confident, hiking gear and all, while Bruyas and his servant are kind of bowing to him.
Exactly. The patron paying respects to the artist. Critics hated it, called him incredibly vain. But Courbet saw it as his declaration of artistic self-sufficiency, flipping the old script where the artist was just a hired hand for the rich.
Okay, so he tackled social hierarchy, artistic independence, and then he turned his sights on the nude. Which caused, let's say, even more problems.
Absolutely. If his realism was politically tricky, his nudes were an aesthetic and moral bombshell. He completely rejected the classical tradition of the idealized, perfect, usually mythological female form.
He just wanted to paint real bodies.
Unvarnished bodies, yes.
Yeah.
The big scandal was the Bathers in 1853. It wasn't just that the woman was nude, it was that she looked like a real solid, maybe even slightly grubby peasant woman.
They pointed out her heavy figure and I think dirty feet. It was the lack of idealization that was shocking.
Precisely. The critics went nuts.
Yeah.
One famously called her a kind of Hottentot Venus, basically comparing her to racist caricatures of African women to imply she was coarse or uncivilized. Courbet was deliberately using that earthiness to shatter the fantasy.
Did he ever tone it down?
A little, maybe. Woman with a Parrot from 1866 actually got accepted into the Salon. The model's thought to be Joanna Heffernan, Whistler's partner at the time.
But it's still pretty realistic, right? And not exactly a goddess.
Not at all. The body's candid, the hair's messy. She's just lying there. The parrot adds a touch of sensuality. It's still a rejection of the academic ideal, just maybe slightly more approachable.
You see that contrast really clearly if you put the source from 1862 next to the famous one by Ingres.
Right. Ingres' source is this flawless, perfectly smooth, allegorical nymph pouring water. Pure idealization. Courbet paints a real woman in nature, maybe cooling off by a stream. It's just sincere observation, not mythology.
But then he goes further than anyone expected with The Origin of the World, 1866. Still probably one of the most startling paintings ever made.
Commissioned privately by Khalil Bey, an Ottoman diplomat. And it's just uncompromising realism. The way it's framed is radical, too.
It's just the torso and genitals, right? No face, no context, almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It forces you to confront the physical reality. No allegory, no mythology to hide behind. The title itself, The Origin of the World, points to this raw, generative power of the female body. It's frank, direct.
And that painting had a pretty wild history itself, didn't it? Hidden away for ages.
For over a century. It was privately owned, famously by the psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, who actually hid it behind another landscape painting he commissioned. Its existence was almost a rumor for a long time. Now it's on public display, still provoking debate. That's pure Courbet.
So his art was radical, his politics were radical. Eventually those things collided head on, didn't they? With serious consequences for him.
They did. His enthusiastic support for the Paris Commune in 1871, that short-lived revolutionary government, cost him dearly. He was arrested and imprisoned for 6 months.
And it wasn't just jail time. They blamed him for tearing down the Vendôme Column, Napoleon's big monument.
Yes, a symbol of the empire they despised. He was held responsible, maybe not for physically pulling it down, but as a leading figure in the Commune's cultural efforts.
And the punishment was financial ruin, basically.
Pretty much. He was ordered to pay the entire cost of rebuilding it, an absolutely immense fine he could never afford. It was a crippling blow, clearly meant to punish his political stance.
So what did he do? He couldn't pay.
He fled. Went into exile in Switzerland in 1873, settling in La Tour de Pilds near Lake Geneva to avoid being thrown back in prison for the debt.
So his final years were spent in exile. That sounds pretty bleak.
They were marked by isolation, yeah, and his health declined. But the sources stress he remained unbent, defiant to the end.
And he kept painting, even then. Did his style change?
He focused intensely on nature, especially the sea. His late seascapes from around 1869, painted near Etretat in Normandy before the Commune, are incredible. He's using palette knives, thick paint, really vigorous.
Like the wave, that famous one.
Exactly. It's just pure nature's power. No people, just the force of the water. It feels like another unflinching confrontation, but this time between the viewer and the elements.
And there's that other one, the vastness of the sea. Much calmer.
L'immensité, yeah. So simple. Just sea, sky, horizon at low tide. Really minimalist. It captures this incredible stillness.
And people saw something new in those late works.
Definitely. Critics saw hints of impressionism in the brushwork and the focus on light and atmosphere. It shows he wasn't just a rebel. He was still pushing forward, bridging the gap towards what came next.
So summing it all up then, Courbet really forced the art world to look at things it didn't want to see. Ordinary people, unidealized bodies, raw nature.
And he insisted they deserve the same respect, the same scale as the old grand subjects. He helped shift art from romanticism towards modernism by valuing truth, observed reality above all else.
That rebellious spirit really did clear the path for artists like Monet, Cezanne, Renoir. He changed the game, risked everything, freedom, money, reputation, to make sure that people saw things as they were.
He absolutely did. His legacy is that insistence on truth, however uncomfortable.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you, the listener. Considering everything, the political turmoil, the artistic scandals, what was Courbet's most revolutionary act? Was it painting something as explicit and taboo-breaking as The Origin of the World? Or was it taking an ordinary man's funeral and painting it on the scale of a coronation, challenging the whole social order? Something to ponder.